You are listening to Embodied People, a podcast co-hosted by Sarah Donahue and myself, Colleen Wall. We are both somatic movement educators and dance professors. We are also faculty at Integrated Movement Studies. In this podcast, we explore all things embodied. We explore anatomy, we explore meaning, metaphor, and how we make sense of out of our lives through our bodies. We also talk about developmental motor patterning, how it affects our psychological and emotional and psychic states as adults. And we really love to offer you movement practices and meditations that deepen your experience of your body so that your body is a generative place for you in your life. That is, it helps guide you towards and supports you in living the life that is most fulfilling for you. This podcast is sponsored by Integrated Movement Studies, and that is a certification program in the Laban-Bartynieff Movement Studies system. And if you'd like more information on Integrated Movement Studies and what the Laban-Bartynieff system is, beyond what we offer in this podcast, you can check out our website, imsmovement.com. Hey, thanks for being here this week for Embodied People. This is Colleen, and these next two episodes are special. Sarah and I get to interview each other. And the idea behind this is that there's a whole human with a whole life behind these ideas and these podcasts. And so in interviewing Sarah, we're going to hear about the person and the sort of how she got to doing this instead of, say, being an accountant or an engineer, which are very great professions, but not the one that she and I chose for ourselves. So Sarah grew up sort of a free range kid in the woods of Colorado, mountain biking and skiing, and spent her early adult years as a professional dancer for repertory dance theater, and is now a associate professor of dance at Utah Valley University, and a mom. And so there's a lot of full bodied lives that Sarah has lived up until this point. So we're going to hear about some of those. So thanks for being here, Sarah.
Hey, thank you. I like being a free range chicken. It sounds right.
So my first question for you, to kind of get us started is, instead of going back in the past, I'm actually interested in what right now is the meaning or the pulse. What are you interested in your embodied practices right now?
I right now, if I just, I'm gonna like think off the top of my head, is I am loving teaching a lot. Like, I'm loving being in the studio with students. I teach technique every day, modern contemporary technique every day. I teach a Laban class this semester, and then I get to teach for IMS. And I just love being in that space. And I think a big part of it is like connecting empathetically with the students. And I think I've gotten like a little bit better at that with age. I know when I was a young teacher and I started teaching at the university right out of grad school, so I was a pretty young teacher. You know, I was more concerned with like, what was I saying? And what was, you know, like, am I following my lesson plan? And am I doing the right movements and that sort of thing? And while I still try to demonstrate movement clearly and, you know, convey material clearly, it's just become so much more about like noticing where the students are and almost this sort of like embodied empathetic connection that I can kind of tap into with them to, you know, to kind of notice where they are in the experience. And this is still from my perspective, of course, but just noticing like, oh, where's the weight shift, or where's the, you know, what sort of connections might they find more clearly in that or investigate more. So I'm loving that as an educator. I'm loving this place of feeling comfortable where I can really, really open my eyes to what's in front of me and to hopefully provide like the most helpful tools or suggestions or conversations for the students to have their own journey, their own like personal journey, because that's what they have to do, you know. And it's become less about me saying, try these things, here's how to dance and put this into your body and make your body into this shape, and more about like asking them questions so that they can like send it through their senses and come up with it.
It's really interesting that you, the body part that you talked about, I think the only body part that you named was your eyes. And I have been thinking about a version of this also, and I think it came from my mom, which was like, if you're not sure what to teach next, look at your students.
Yeah.
And they'll tell you. And I have been like, sometimes I get so worried about like getting my whatever toe to do the thing on the right count or remembering the right words. And like, I just am like, lately I've been thinking, eyes, use your eyes, look at them. And so it's interesting that that is the body part that you talked about too, and that has some level of like mastery at this point in our teaching careers.
Yeah. The other thing, which feels like so different and makes me feel like a novice kind of all over again, the other part of my life that's super active right now is playing with my son, Everett, who is 6 and a half, and all he wants to do right now is play kickball and football. And Colleen, he's really excited you're coming to visit because I told him that you play football. And he was like, when is she coming? So get ready.
I'll practice my spiral. Yeah.
No,
my tackle.
I mean, it's been like a real like movement. Like I have to like up my game literally because he's super active, and he like after school, that's what he wants to do for hours. So I have been like, okay. And my shoulder is a little sore from like trying to get the spiral. And it's this level of activity that I used to do a lot, you know, but I'm like, wow, this is like, I'm feeling like a beginner at it again in many ways. Like how to kick the ball so it doesn't hurt my foot, and you know, so it's interesting to feel like I am feeling at this like place of refinement in my teaching, I think, and then after school I'm like, whoa, you know, like how do you catch a ball? So yeah, two sides there.
Yeah. Yeah, but how enlivening to be learning a new skill, even if it means planting the left foot and arcing the right foot and thinking stability through one side to mobilize the leg to kick the other side. Yeah. The activation of the edges of your body to respond to kicking balls and flying footballs is very different than the dancer experience of seeking. I think most of the time we are seeking to control our bodies by anticipating and knowing what comes next, which is really different than the reactivity of sports often, especially ball sports, where you're seeing or feeling what's happening around you and then physically responding in an improvisatory way.
Yeah. And they both feel really good. Like it, you know, like the more I play football, the better it feels. It's like there's something very satisfying about it also. So yeah, I'm enjoying that quite a bit. It's also tiring. After a couple hours, I'm like, I'm tired. I'm done.
And I'm sure Everett is not tired.
He's not tired. Lots of energy with that one.
So Sarah, I know that some of your research right now has been on play, speaking of playing with Everett, has been on play in bringing that into the dance classroom and the classes that you're teaching. Can you talk about what you're seeing happening in the classroom with your students as you sort of bring play into the classroom?
Yeah. I would say like the zoomed out version is when they are in a place of play I see them relax, just to put it simply. I see like extra muscular tension kind of fall away. I see their like chests open and their focus like open. They connect to each other like 1,000 times more than when they're kind of isolated and maybe tunneled into focusing on their technique like we typically would in a technique class. So there's just a sense of ease and flow. They are receptive and available. It feels like they're physically available. And some of the games we brought into technique class, even though we're still really trying to integrate technique and play. So like maintaining a technique class that is what they signed up for, you know, but implementing these different games kind of throughout the semester, throughout the day. I just see them like, it's like they are ready in a different way for the movement. And a lot of, you know, what play does is like you make your own rules, you know, you like it becomes yours in a sense. So, and that's how I use some of the games I've done is, you know, it's like, okay, here's the rules of the game. What I'm getting at in technique is it's a tendu and a plié exercise. You have to do tendus, you have to do dégagés, you need to do a grand plié, a relevé, and some rond de jambes. Like, so dance stuff, you got to incorporate those, but then like throwing in some other things, you know, you have to, if you come across someone, you have to like skip through the room with them at some point, or you have to copy somebody, or you have to like be like, I'm the teacher. You just like tell someone like, I'm the teacher, and they have to follow you. So we just would throw in lots of different rules about it. But then, you know, in the midst of all that, I would kind of still be checking out their like technique and their technical skills. And because they were creating it themselves, and because they were working from this place of low stakes, you know, they weren't being assessed in the way that they usually are, or the way they think they're being assessed or evaluated, they were performing it even better. Like their technique was very clear. Their tendus were very clear. They went down and up in a grand plié without stressing out about if it was going to work or not. So it's been really, really inspiring. And the feedback from them has been like, they need it. For, you know, a lot of what they've said is they need it for like mental health and to keep them going and motivated. And I did this really like purposefully last semester with our like senior group of students. And we were just like, let's fight the burnout. Let's fight the like senioritis that happens. And it really, I think it worked. I think they reported back that it was like they looked forward to coming to class and doing, you know, this work because there was this playful element in it.
It makes me really think about how play for children is like a place to practice what's possible. Yep. It's not about getting it right or doing it a good job at it. It's a place to practice an idea, practice what's possible. And it's really expressive and it feels good. And so when something feels good and it's expressive, I also think like when I think back at some of the most major breakthroughs I've had in my own embodied understanding, like, they came often from silliness. Like I remember one night in college, I don't know, might've been Halloween or something, but I was decided to be a world-class Olympic roller skater. And so I put on high socks and short pink shorts and a helmet. And I pretended to roller skate or rollerblade to the bar, but I had sneakers on and I was just arcing my feet and I was excited and I learned about yielding and pushing, like grounding and propelling my pelvis. And at the same time I was studying anatomy and they were talking about the pyramidalis, which is a muscle that connects the pubic bone to like the navel center that for most people atrophies. And by the end of the night, I was pretty convinced. I may have had some alcohol, but I was pretty convinced that I found my pyramidalis in all that yielding and pushing as a world-class rollerblader. And had I been practicing yielding and pushing forever, I don't think I would have gotten there.
Right. You're like, could have been Halloween, could have maybe just been a day.
Could have been a night in college where we did those things. Go ahead.
Oh, you're just that thing about how play, it creates possibilities. Yeah. You know, it creates more contingency plans for like how you solve something. And that's learning, right? Like, that's such a wonderful way to learn, that it's not me telling you, here's how to solve the problem of a grand plié, but how do you, what are the ways? Like, what are the possibilities?
Yeah. So that makes me really curious. When did you start dancing? How did you start dancing? And what at that time do you think dance was offering you?
Yeah, I feel so lucky about this. I definitely started dancing because there was music playing. Mm. Like, that's what it was. And my parents always had music on. I remember like the record player, and I remember the records and the record covers, you know, like I remember that so well. And we had music on a lot, and we would all dance. Like, my whole family would dance, you know? And so I just remember these like dance parties, like, you know, and I think just having that connection to music was like, I'm just so glad that that was my entry into dance. And not to, you know, take anything away from anyone who just was plopped into a ballet class when they were little, but that wasn't my entry. It was, and I was, you know, so a kid, starting to do that. And I grew up in Durango, Colorado. So very outside of Durango. So a very small town, and there wasn't any dance at all when I was growing up. And then there was like one little studio that popped up in a nearby town. And so I think I was, like 10 maybe or something when I actually like first took a dance class, maybe 10 or 12. I can't remember exactly, but I mean, I always loved the feeling of my body moving. And so like the free dancing in the living room with my family, it turned into me wanting to create dances and remember them before I ever was like taught to do that. So it must have been before 10, but anyway, so yeah, like fourth grade talent show, I, you know, choreographed a whole thing to Fine Young Cannibals. She drives me crazy. And, you know, and I enjoyed the process of like putting together the movement and remembering it. But it was still very much tied to music, because like the chorus would always have the same movement, you know, because the chorus repeated. And it was all just so, so linked to the music. But yeah, so that was my start. I had a lot of training since then. You know, the little school I danced at was that. It was a little dance school in Colorado. And then when I went to my undergrad in University of Arizona, that was like, boom. That was the like opposite of play. It was a great school, wonderful teachers. I remember so much of what they offered me, but it was definitely like a conservatory type of place. And I remember, like, I can think about how my body changed in those years, not just like gaining technique or something like that, although I did, but just like the seriousness of dance came into play. It's funny I said it that way, but the seriousness came in, and the etiquette and the leotard and tights every day, and the, you know, just that, like the rigor, like it was very rigorous and not always fun, you know, definitely not always fun. There was a lot of struggle and a lot of tears and a lot of questioning if this was like the right thing for me to do. And it really, like, I felt like it changed a lot, like how I felt about movement also. Cause for the first time, it wasn't always enjoyable, you know? So yeah. So that was a real interesting part. I wonder if like subconsciously, that's why I want to bring play into my current undergraduate students' life, because they take themselves very seriously, and that's fine. Their art form is important to them, but I really think you can gain just as much technical like ability through a little bit more lighthearted approach to it sometimes.
Yeah, wow. And it it actually also helps me see the inner rebellion inside of you that is making this research, the play research that you're doing in your classroom, even more important.
Yeah.
It's like you're bridging from the earliest love. And I mean, you are a, to me, just a wicked skilled technician as a dancer. But I see the rebellion and I see the personal import in a different way. Did you go to college with the intention of a life in dance?
Yeah, I did. And I mean, I think I had that part of me always as well. Like that real determination, you know, that like I loved the feeling of dancing and I was very determined to, I wanted it to be my life. I think my, like I played sports as well as a kid and in high school, I think part of that like really set up that sort of like determination, sometimes perfectionism, you know, of and like a competitive edge sometimes as well. I ran track and played soccer and skied and biked and stuff like that. And so I had that desire to like excel, you know, and to like win. I really did. And so, you know, that like, yeah, I think from a young age, I was like, I want to be a dancer. I mean, I remember thinking I want to be a ballerina. And then when I got to college, I was like, wow, just kidding. No, I'm not that good. And then I was like, I want to be on Broadway. And I was like, oh, wait, maybe not, not for me. So I knew I wanted to dance, but I didn't know how, you know, at the time. But yeah.
Yeah, I often tell students that part of being in college is being exposed to things that you haven't had an opportunity to be exposed to yet. You've been exposed to your parents or caretakers, friends in your community's parents, if you have them around, aunts and uncles, but like most people have experienced a very small range of what's possible for them. And so part of college is opening up the range of possibilities. And hopefully it's the years after that, that you have more of those openings, because it's like, I think it takes 15 or 20 years, 15 to 30 to see enough possibilities for ourselves before we can even start to form our and move ourselves into the position to live those out. And so, yeah, that's really formative years. Sarah, we met when you were in your like early 20s as a graduate student in your MFA at the University of Utah, MFA in dance. And you got the scholarship, which is now the Cadence Whittier Scholarship. So how was it that you found your way to University of Utah and also then to IMS?
Yeah, so out of my undergrad, when I graduated from U of A, I went back to Colorado and I was teaching a lot, like in studios, which was so great. Like it was such a wonderful 2 years of my life where I had like every teaching experience possible. I remember I had like 2-year-olds all the way up to like adults, every, you know, and they'd be like, can you teach jazz? And I was like, yes, you know, I would just be like, uh-huh, I'll figure it out. So I just taught a range of classes to a range of people, like a lot. And it was so good. It was such good like information that I've taken with me still, you know. And then also in that time, I always wanted to dig in a little bit more. I found like an old notebook of like, it was kind of like a lecture I was like preparing for one of my studio classes and like diving into the creative process. And I just like, it was that thing. I was like, I want to teach college students, you know, like I just had that desire to like go to that level of education that doesn't necessarily always happen in studio settings, but so that's what took me to the University of Utah for their master's program. Okay, and then this is like almost embarrassing, but I'm gonna say it anyway. So when I went to when I went to audition for the master's program, at the time they said, so we have this like residence, like this program here, integrated movement studies. And there's a couple scholarships that are available. Raise your hand if you're interested in being considered for one of those scholarships. And I was just like, yeah, sure. You know, like I kind of had heard of Laban. Like I raised my hand because I was like, money sounds good.
You know? Free money, take.
So yeah, I was like, of course. And then I got it and I got a scholarship. And okay, and this is like, maybe sounds cheesy and maybe sounds like a shameless plug, but like, I think it is the thing that like changed my dancing in a way that I could dance professionally. I had good technique. I was an athlete, so I had like that physical ability, but I wasn't able to like see movement clearly enough or learn movement clearly enough to really like take me to that level until I had the IMS program under my belt. And it really truly like changed the way I moved in so many ways. It changed the way I could see movement and learn movement. And I think it is truly like what took me, you know, into my teaching career, but also into my professional career.
I remember you as very quiet and mysterious. I mean, I remember that we like easily played. We were the same age, but I remember thinking she's so mysterious. And I remember feeling like there was so much inside of you that seemed to know, like seemed to have a wisdom, but that it felt very private. And as I like think about you then and what I saw change in you over that year, it was almost like that program got you to experience that it was okay or safe for what's inside of you to be expressed out. And whether that was verbally, kinesthetically, physically, it was like the bridge between the inner became something that could also exist in the outer. And I can see that would transform your dancing, because on stage you are having to manifest what's inside, outside, and clarify an intent physically so that it can be seen.
Yeah, it feels like, and we were talking about this a little bit before we started the recording, but like coming from that pretty intense training in my undergrad and lots of questioning of like, am I good enough? Am I doing the right thing? Is it, you know, like really like a lack of confidence, you know, and then like auditioning for this, not getting in, that sort of thing that kind of patters you down after a while. I think IMS, it was at first an unfamiliar place to like, there was a lot of play happening. There was a lot of like silliness. There was a lot of, like, I'm supposed to like go into this like place where I'm jumping around and acting like, you know, this, and I wasn't always on board with it. I remember kind of being like, that's not really what it's not, it wasn't what I was used to. I was like a trained dancer, you know, like I was like, this feels kind of outside of my realm. And but I think when I could let that in, you know, when I could like let that playful side back in, which is, yeah, it's funny that now it's like where I am, you know, in my like interests, but when I could let it back in, then it was like, I don't know, there was something, it just like that the lack of confidence or the like doubting myself started to fall away, you know. And it's not to say that we all don't like doubt ourselves from time to time or lack confidence in something, but in terms of my dancing, I remember this like shift where I was just like, I have the tools to figure this out, you know. And really, I like the tools came from the IMS program. Like I was like, I literally have a ton of tools now to figure out the movement. And I don't need to worry about if like I am doing it correctly or I am, you know. And it really like, it took out that thing that was just like gnawing and saying like, are you doing this right? Are you good enough? Or, you know, and it was like, once that was out of the way, then I could just feel the movement and just like be in the movement. And yeah, I remember, you know, when dancing with Repertory Dance Theater, more toward the end of my career with them, because at the beginning there was kind of more back to that, like, oh, so am I really supposed to be here? Am I good enough? All that stuff. But yeah, towards the end of it, I felt like this playground for me, like all the dances that we learned which was a lot, and they were all different and all like very, you know, diverse rep. And I was like, I could just play in it. So it was just a joy. Like I could learn it quickly. I could, like, my body could do it. And then I could allow, like, the expression just to, like, fully come out, because there wasn't anything blocking it. So yeah, it felt like a huge, huge gift to me to get that scholarship that day I raised my hand.
I have such vivid memories of learning from your contributions to the group. So for people who are listening, a big part of learning movement, especially at IMS, is the sharing physically, verbally, the sharing with each other that contributes to a larger pool of knowledge and experience. And I remember what you are learning and your ability to articulate it is so very useful to me in my learning. And I think one of the ones I most remember, because I still practice this, so maybe I've altered it in my mind over 20 years, okay, was you were riding your, I think it was your road bike, and you were finding the psoas, which is like the deep core, through the medial chain, so the inside of the legs into the arch of the foot, as a way to press through for cycle feet. And yeah. Zoom, zoom, cycle beat, that you could generate a lot of speed and power that way. And I had not experienced that inner chain power yet. And when you described it, something about what popped open for you over that weekend, which was actually, I guess, play, gave me that. And I could see it on your body that Monday. Like, we were doing lateral weight shifts, and I remember seeing you yield over one leg to then transfer your weight to a new base of support. And I was like, oh, and I could see it. And I was like, I want that for myself. Sarah has just opened a new world for me.
I think that that's a good point, you know, is that it's so useful to do things like outside of maybe your typical movement experience, you know, that like, yes, dance is my main gig, but like I find these connections through other things sometimes more easily, you know, like just being able to like go for a hike and just like just thinking about what my body's doing and how it's moving is like, oh, I can learn so much in that moment that I can bring back to the complex world of three-dimensional dance movement, you know, or yeah, the repetitive movement of cycling, and but then being like, whoa, why am I shifting up because my psoas is working. So yeah, just it's, I think that's also a great part of play, is that it's something novel, you know, we take in these experiences through like a new way of doing it, like it's a novel way of looking at something, and then you can learn about that thing, you know, you can learn about the subject, but just from like a different place,
which is fun. Building the sensation of being able to do something through play, I think, builds our confidence to do it in a place that's harder. So when we can find confidence in something in an easy place, then if we know it on some level, we translate it to a place that's more vulnerable.
Yeah, definitely.
So, you know, we've sort of jumped through the main roles in some of your education. But I'm interested in like a couple other things. And one is, how has your embodied somatic knowledge helped you through some of the hard parts of life? So, you know, I know that life is not always just as easy as like the ahas of IMS. But the ahas of IMS, I think, also can help us navigate the challenges, and the things that don't always feel so good. And do you have any examples of how that knowledge has helped you with the harder things?
Yeah, I mean, I think like coming back to your body, knowing that it's yours and it's not going to go anywhere. And so it is kind of this, it can be this like place of like calm and a place of like home in a sense. And yeah, so I'm thinking like my first thought, as probably many people's, is like, you know, the very challenging time of the pandemic and the stress around that, and you know, coupled with the like racial and social injustice happening at the time and, you know, political upheaval, like all that, everything that was happening at that time was so hard and so stressful. And I was kind of in charge of moving our whole dance program off, you know, out of the studios into like online teaching and figuring all that out. And then kind of hybrid, you know, like multimodal teaching after that. And it was a lot. And at the same time, I was also like, my child still doesn't have a vaccine because he's too young. And the stress of trying to like make sure my kid was safe, you know? And so, but I think like being able to, I mean, breathe, just like come back to like, okay, what I do have is my body, and it can either be a source of, you know, stress. And it was at times, like it was probably like the only time I've ever had like a true migraine, you know, that sort of thing like happened where it kind of, my body kind of got overwhelmed by what was happening. So just being conscious of that and just letting myself kind of like at the end of the day, I could lay in bed and I could release, you know, the tension in my face and just like, and I would do that almost every night, just kind of lay and just be like, just let things fall into the pillow, let the release your chin and your neck and your chest. And I had to kind of keep my body as this, like I need to keep it well enough to keep me going now, you know, I have to keep it calm and breathing and flowing. And so it took more conscious effort for sure at that time, but I also knew it was the thing that I could count on, was that like I can come back into home of my body when I need to, when it seems like the rest of the world might just like explode or something. Like, I know that I've got this. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think I pull on that from time to time now, when things, you know, things are not as chaotic as they were, but just things, you know, anything from like a difficult conversation or, you know, like stress that comes up at work or those sorts of challenging moments. Just almost like letting my body be the sort of calm baseline, like a calm undercurrent of like movement and flow and breath. Just those things alone can kind of help support me in whatever the difficulties are. If I have to put up a boundary or if I have to kind of fight for something a little bit, I've got this like calm undercurrent within me.
Yeah. Like me at the center of it, it can be calm to handle and quiet, can handle the chaos out there. And, you know, it reminds me of the core distal pattern too, of me, like the senses of the head end, the limbs folding into center, me knowing myself, and then seeing the world, the eyes and senses of the head end going out and the hands and limbs going out, not me, that's the world. And that when we have a clear sense of me and at the core of me, what's mine and what's not mine, I think we can organize a calmness inside of ourselves while other things are happening. And it doesn't mean that we are totally armored against it and shut off, but that I can navigate the distance and the relationship between a center and what's happening out there.
Yeah.
And also, I mean, I remember going, it really makes sense to me what you're saying, that calmness is, and as life marches on and more challenges happen, getting more and more familiar with that calm center by coming into the sensations of the body instead of distancing the sensations of the body, but coming into the sensations of the body in order to navigate the challenges.
I think a lot of that might have come from also just my upbringing, I think, like where, like my free range chicken part, that like I feel so grounded in space, like environment, mm-hmm. wide open space, and like that, how that is calming to me. And I think I kind of carry that with me in a way that like I grew up where it was quiet and we played in the dirt and heard the wind, and you know, there was, it was cold and it was hot, and it was like, there was, that was my environment, you know, that was my, if you think, I always think about like, you know, you plop a little creature into like an aquarium, and that's its reality now, and it's going to shape how it lives and how it moves. And if it's a circular aquarium compared to a rectangular one, you know, what's in it, like, it's just going to change the way the little creature moves and lives and how they react to things. And so, yeah, so having like growing up where I did, you know, where it was like for the most part very quiet, and the solitude and all of that, it just it's what grounds me still. And I think it's why I also seek it when I, like when I need it, you know, like I have to get out when I feel like things are starting to pile up in terms of stress or this or that. It's like, oh, gotta go to the mountains and not hear anything for a while. So yeah.
If we connect with an elemental world that isn't necessarily as connectable in our houses and offices and computer screens. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I know that, I think this is okay to offer. I know that you just reset a dance that you made in college.
Oh, yeah.
And then you added, and that first version I understand is pretty zany and dynamic and playful. And then you added a new section on grief.
Yeah.
And so what, when you can like sort of zoom out with squinty eyes, what are the movement elements that were part of the section on grief?
Yeah. There is that like full body shudder that happens, that like when you're like, you are crying and you're not going to not cry. It's like fully happening. That was like a main like motif in it, was just that, that sense of involuntary, like shuddering, I think is the best way to put it probably. There was, you know, I create movement and then sometimes I'm like, oh, right. That's like, it's a movement memory from like a dance I did. Sorry. That's my door making a noise. A dance I did, you know, with RDT or something. So there's this like movement of like, kind of like the hand kind of arcing around and like piercing the gut a little bit, and kind of almost like if you were like giving yourself the Heimlich. So it was this sort of like kind of piercing, lifting the gut up. And I think also just that, like that thing that happens in grief where you lose a sense of space, your like connection mm-hmm. to, you lose your connection to the environment sometimes in like real grief, you know, that not real grief, but like intense grief, where you're just lost in what we call passion drive, maybe in our Laban world, but you're just kind of lost in your emotions and the swirl of them. And those were some of the things. And I set the piece on a student, and I didn't really talk too much about like my own personal connection to it. And you know, and I didn't need to. Everyone has experienced grief at some point probably. And so she, like, you know, I just wanted her to come to it with like her connection in that way. But yeah, definitely like as I was doing it, you know, it kind of just, I was like, okay, wow. Yeah. This is like revealing parts of my recent life that, you know, I've had to like confront and move through. And yeah, and I think it was cathartic, as choreography can be, you know, sometimes, but it was also in the vein of what we'll call Donna humor sometimes. There was the, like the light end of it too, like at, you know, at the very end there's like a little part, because it's also it's grief about like a dead plastic bag. is like how it starts. And so the audience was actually laughing when it started, when this section started. And then as it went on, they were like, this person in front of me goes, oh no. Like he was like, just like, no, like, just like really like felt like this bag, this plastic bag that they'd been, had been alive in the earlier section was now dead. And so it was kind of interesting. It was, I mean, I was happy that the audience could connect in that way, even though it was about, you know, seemingly about a plastic bag. It was obviously about more than that, but yeah, the movement material wasn't difficult to come up with at all because it was there, you know, like I lost my dad, like a year and a half ago, and I lost my dog before that. And there's been other parts of grief in my life lately. So it wasn't, it was there, like the tapping into the, like the physicality of grief was pretty immediate and available, I guess.
Two things I want to share is one, how beautiful that it was a plastic bag. Like that is what we fill to bring things into and out of our lives. I bring my groceries and my material possessions in, and then I take them out to the curb. Like that is the container of transition or traveling. It's so appropriate in some ways. And yet its emptiness also is, speaks to the metaphor of how we fill it, like we fill our lives.
Yeah.
And so it's deflating. But also the two other things, like the idea, the image of being gutted and like the bag is being gutted and being gutted, like going deep into the guts, which I think is a place that grief takes us. It also means emptying the guts, and the guts get emptied and then ready to be filled again.
Yeah.
I mean, the gutting can be so deep, like cleaning and cleaning and cleaning out a container, and then they're ready again for some,
right.
There's space again for something new.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that. I like that. Yeah, it's true. It feels like, almost like that, like a suction, you know, like almost like that psoas suction that we can feel when we're like really accessing our deep, deep muscles, just like it's just kind of pulled out of you. Or yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And then, pulled out of you, like the wind knocked out of you for a long time. Almost like you can feel the front and back touching each other.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Yeah.
There's time somehow through the front. Yeah.
Yeah. I also am thinking about the passing on of movement. Like I think culturally it's more familiar to think about how we pass on language, words, but we pass on movement, like from your parents teaching, you know, creating the container to dance in the house to music, passed on an idea of what dance and movement could be. And the RDT, you know, being gutted in movement language that you got from that time in your life and your teaching of the deep hollowing psoas at IMS. But these are transmissions of a physical knowing.
Yeah. Yeah. And the, you know, the whole piece, it's called Wild Air. The whole piece came from a game my brother and I played as kids when my mom would bring home the groceries, or we'd, you know, bring the groceries home in the plastic bag. And then my brother and I would like catch air and like fill up the bag and then be like, I've got wild air. And just like it would take us through the house and we would just go nuts with these like plastic bags of air. It was like, that was like the game that we played. And so yeah, like that it reappeared when I was in grad school and then reappeared now, you know, is I so appreciate, you know, my students who fully went there with me. Like they were so great at just playing, you know, and I let them know, it's like this is you have to play to do this. You have to like fully believe what you're doing. You know, it's not pantomime or it's not acting. It's like you're so in this thing, like a kid is so into play that it's, you know, you fully believe it. And they totally went there. They were just so invested in these plastic bags that were, you know, taking them for a ride. So it was, yeah, it was such a gift to be able to do that.
Do you have a link to it that I could put in the show notes?
Yeah, I'll send you one. Yeah.
That would be awesome. Yeah, I'll make sure to drop it in there. Sarah, in closing, based on this conversation, so I'm asking you like totally in the moment, as this whole conversation has been, but totally in the moment, where, if you were to leave listeners with something in their sensei embodied knowing to guide them, where would you take us?
I'll just go with the first thing that popped in my head, which is just, I think, to open sometimes. I think just to like notice if you're opening. And, you know, so that can be in so many ways, like just to like literally physically open your body, open your eyes, open your face, you know, to kind of take in the world. Of course, like opening your mind to new options or possibilities or ways of learning. Yeah, I think it's easy to get closed around what we're focused on sometimes. And sometimes that's helpful, of course, to like, I love getting focused in on something and closing around ideas and digging into something. I love that feeling. But I think being able to remain open and to feel yourself opening to others and to yourself and, you know, to your environment, I think something maybe to take along with you.
Sarah, thanks for opening your life and embodied knowing to us today.
Of course. Thank you. It was fun to kind of move back through the past number of decades. So thank you, Colleen.
Yeah, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you.